your departure.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato, and I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you on March 4th, 2010, and on the line with us again is our good friend Albert Lanier, on the line from Honolulu. Thanks for coming back, man.
Well, thank you for having me once again here on Media Monarchy, and it's nice to be back here, and it's nice to talk to you once again, James.
Absolutely. So we definitely want to tell folks that this is actually the third time you and I have talked. And so in the show notes, we'll have the links back to those previous interviews where the first time we talked about the crisis in journalism. And then the second time we talked about conspiracies and secret societies in mainstream films. And we do want to make the mention, too, that you are a film critic. And maybe a brief mention on some of the things recently going on. We, of course, have the Oscars coming up in just a couple of days from now. Any thoughts or maybe any follow-up on our conspiracy film talk?
I actually have pitched the idea for that to a publisher. I haven't gotten any formal response yet, so I'm waiting to hear back from that, whether that will pan out. And in regards to the Oscars, it's an interesting Oscars this year because of some of the films. One of the more talked about films, nauseatingly so, is Avatar, which is directed by James Cameron. But another film, we were discussing this before we went on the air, so to speak, is The Hurt Locker, the Catherine Bigelow film. I know that you're a big fan of that movie. And that's interesting. That, of course, is dealing with soldiers in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And I think typically, historically, movies about wars we're currently in don't bode well during awards time. But
right. But you never know. Some war films do well. Like, for example, probably Wars in the Past. For example, Patton won the Oscar. Or George C. Scott. He also won an Oscar for Best Actor. Some war films do well. Of course, there's Platoon, which is about the Vietnam War. Patton, of course, about World War II, largely. It's also about George Patton. So some war films do all right. Of course, you could argue that Patton is also more of a biopic, but it's also dealing with war. Some war films do well. Another good example is The Deer Hunter.
Okay, I was just going to mention that.
Deer Hunter actually to me is more of a film about friendship. It's set during war instead of the Vietnam War. I've always seen the Deer Hunter as a film about friendship, and that's why it works for me. As a film exclusively about Vietnam, it has its problems. I don't really buy the fact that the Vietnamese, when I saw it, I said I couldn't buy the fact that the Vietnamese would build camps right in the middle of a stream or a river. Could easily be bombed by U.S. airplanes. That didn't work for me. But as a film about friendship, it's very powerful. So some war films or war-oriented films do well. Whether the Hurt Locker will win, I wouldn't be surprised. I will not be surprised.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen kind of the tide turning for it. And there's a lot of me that wants to see it win just because I find James Cameron such kind of a smug, over-the-top guy. I would like to see a female win a directing Oscar.
Well, that's very interesting. Catherine Bigelow, of course, I believe is the director of Hurt Locker. And it would be interesting to see a female director. Not too many female directors have been nominated for Oscar.
No, she's the fourth in, what, 80 years.
Yeah.
So, District 9 is actually probably my favorite movie of the last year, not having seen a ton of the films that are up for the Academy Awards this year, but District 9 just kind of had it all for me as just the way it was shot, the feeling of it. Sure, it's a science fiction film, but it feels so kind of gritty and real the way that they shot it and used sort of a cinema verite, almost documentary style.
Right. Well, it's been an interesting year in regards to films. Some interesting content matter has come out in regards to films.
Oh, and you know, we just had, actually, sorry to interrupt you, they finally did just release Shutter Island, which we were talking about in October because it was about to come out in October. And that film, of course, has, you know, CIA mind control storyline.
Of course, he's the DiCaprio character is actually going to investigate what's going on at a, I think it's an insane asylum or something like that on an island. So, and that film's doing very well.
It is. So,
number one film.
A lot of times you think when studios hold back on movies, it's because they think they have a stinker on their hands, but maybe in this case they knew they didn't have a, you know, wintertime prestige Academy Award, but they were ready as soon as maybe the holidays were over.
Right. It's interesting because they held off on this movie and they released it in a soft portion. I think it was released in February. That's a soft part of the year because it's basically, it's just before spring, which is what we're in now, March. So there, it's, I would call it a soft part of the soft season, which is January, February.
And I think it's also when studios are dumping their real stinkers. So Shutter Island didn't have a whole lot of real competition.
I think that was intentional. I think they decided, okay, we're going to put it on, you know, in February. We're going to put it before the first big, you know, box office season, which is spring. So I that very conscious decision, I think, on Paramount's part. I believe Paramount is the distributor of Shutter Island. Hmm. So I think it's deliberate. And it seems to be doing very well right now.
All right. Well, let's actually now, since now that we've had kind of the brief movie discussion, let's actually, we'll delve into the topic at hand today. And it's something...
which deserves a film of its own, frankly.
Exactly, which, you know, we haven't seen. This is something that is very simply referred to by many as the octopus. And what this involves is the case of a freelance journalist who, at the time of his death in 1991, was researching an insidious and wide-ranging conspiracy that connects to everything from the October surprise and Iran-Contra to espionage and software and the Department of Justice and 9/11 and all of those things. But the way we want to try and approach the tentacles of this octopus is, I think, through the human angle. And basically, we're talking about a guy named Danny Casolaro.
Right. That's correct. I call this Promise Me, right? Sort of Inflaw and Danny Casolaro. That's my take. That's my my area of interest in this. A Promise, of course, is the software that was developed by a man named William Hamilton under the auspices of Inflaw.
So let's actually, well, and I was going to say, because we're going to use a lot of sort of terms and names and things that people, you know, may not wrap their head around immediately.
Right.
So when we're talking about Promise, that's the name of this software that's the Prosecutor's Management Information System. And
correct.
It was developed by INSLAW, which is the Institute for Law and Social Research.
Correct. INSLAW, that was the original name of INSLAW. And they changed, they went from Institute for Law and Social Research to just INSLAW Inc., I believe, in about 1981. That is, of course, the name of it. Promise, of course, is a prosecutor's management information system, which is the software system that was developed by Hamilton and William Hamilton, who, from what I understand, is a former employee of the CIA and the NSA. He was an analyst with the National Security Agency, from what I understand. So that was what Danny Casolaro was initially looking into. That was the first thing he was looking into. And the reason why he was examining Promise and INSLAW was because of what happened with Promise and INSLAW. And basically what happened, I'll get into this later, because we have to first discuss Danny Casolaro himself and his death. But what happened was that he was investigating what happened with INSLAW and Promise. And what occurred in a nutshell, hard to wrap this up in a nutshell, but I'll try. What happened basically was that INSLAW was forced into bankruptcy. And the Department of Justice, with whom they had a contract with, withheld payments and tried to get their hands, basically did get their hands, on Crump for their own reasons, which I will try to illuminate. So basically what happened was that the DOJ screwed Inslaw, and they tried to screw them, and basically did screw them out of permit.
There you go. That's a succinct way of putting it. The Department of Justice contracted the Hamiltons and Inslaw to make the Promise software. They did, and they pretty much screwed them out of it.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. I've read the House Judiciary Committee report. In the early 90s, the House Judiciary Committee under Congressman Jack Brooks had investigated this matter. And basically, they basically found that, and they weren't the only ones. You also had a bankruptcy judge, I believe, Basin, who ruled in favor of the Hamiltons, and basically said that the, Justice Department had used, had basically tried to intimidate them. They used unjust means to force the Hamiltons to try to give up in, promise, and to basically try to force them into bankruptcy. But that, of course, we will get into, I guess, a little later. The first aspect, of course, that we want to look into is the death of Danny Caffalero. So that's our first chapter, chapter one, so to speak. I've just provided the prologue, so now we can get into chapter one, I guess. The death of Danny Caffalero. Just a little bit of background on Danny Caffalero. Danny Caffalero, I believe, was born into a family of six. He's from Virginia, Fairfax County, I believe, Fairfax, Virginia. And he was basically a freelance journalist. He had attended Providence College and he had dropped out. He ended up freelancing for a number of publications. I believe the National Enquirer was one publication he had written for. And he had a lot of interests. I understand he liked racing horses at some point, and he had other interests as well. But what happened is that Caffalero dropped out of journalism to kind of get into computer publications. I think he owned Computer Age, which I believe at the time was one of the few, if not the only, publication dealing with computers in the U.S. So Caffalero was basically the owner of a publication or publications. One of them was Computer Age. And I believe at one point he was basically providing most of the articles to Computer Age, or one of his publications. And he ended up selling these. I don't think he made much of a profit on the sale, but he ended up selling this. And he got back into freelance journalism. And his return to freelance journalism dealt with investigating the Inslaw case. So he was investigating what occurred with Puff. And this is what happened. You know, what was mentioned. Now, from this point onward, his investigation into the Promise affair, I like to call it Promise, but for our purposes, let's just call it Promise. The Promise software and the Inslaw and Inslaw Inc. And his investigation of that led him into what he termed the octopus. Now, what is the octopus? In a nutshell, if you know what a regular octopus looks like, it has a head and it has tentacles. The head of the octopus would be, from what I've read and from what I understand, to be a combination of officials, organized crime figures, and intelligence agency members and veterans. So you have these individuals, and the tentacles from the head of this octopus reach into different scandals that manifested themselves in the 1980s. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal, the Iran-Contra scandal, and of course, the October Surprise scandal. The October Surprise figures into Inslaw, as I'll get into. See, I wasn't joking when I said there's a lot of loose ends. Lisa, I believe I said that.
We did, and that is what can be difficult about going into topics like this because, you know, whether we were talking about, say, just 9/11, there's all the tentacles that separate from that. If we were talking about the Franklin cover-up out of Omaha, you know, there's a whole set of tentacles there. This is a topic that it would be easy to go down different holes and perhaps lose folks. Right. So I think we, you know, we're going to try and keep it, you know, as accessible as possible. And again, we'll provide a lot of the extra links and information for folks to do the research for themselves. But please continue.
I think that's very important. I, of course, have been doing research, but the internet provides the opportunity for people to look into this on their own, and they can easily do this. I would recommend making losing your life to it. But there's a lot that people can do. I mean, one of the warnings that I stress here, and I'll stress it later, is that this subject matter is extensive. I mean, of all the things that I've done interviews about over the past God knows how many months, and past year, I should say, this is probably one of the most extensive that I've researched in 15 years of being a journalist and writer. I don't even think I've hit the bottom of this, you know, vast well, or should I say series of wells. So that's a warning, and I would warn them. There's a lot to this. There's just a lot of information. So anyway, I was discussing Danny, back to chapter one. I was discussing Danny Casolaro, who is, of course, a freelance writer and journalist, or was a freelance writer and journalist. He was returning, and as I mentioned before, he had been a writer for numerous publications. He had freelanced. He was basically a college dropout. He had attended the Providence College, and he had dropped out, gotten into freelancing, got out basically to own and operate computer publications like Computer Age. He sold those off, got back into freelancing, and he was investigating InsLaw and Promise. And it was in the course of this that he developed into the Octopus, which, as I mentioned, for lack of a better term, combines organized crime figures, intelligence veterans, and U.S. officials in something that the tentacles extend to numerous scandals like BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, Iran-Contra, and the October Surprise scandal.
So it also includes the banksters and military as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I haven't even mentioned, you know, the other things that'll probably crop up in this aspect too. But so this is what we see in regards to the Octopus itself. And it was really his submerging into the Octopus, Casolaro's emergence into the Octopus. This is where he was about the time that he died. And he died on August 10th, 1991. Now, let's just set that up. He was working on something that he hoped would be a book. My understanding in terms of what Casolaro hoped to do is he was looking at it more from a fictional point of view. That's what I've read. It's hard, you know, it probably would have been a fictional book with a lot of real life overlays to it, a lot of factual overlays to it. I know that he wanted to write a book called Indio, and I'll get into Indio later. But in any event, Casolaro wanted to was looking into the Octopus, and he went in about early August. We're talking the last few days of his life, so we're talking the 8th, the 9th, 10th, or the 10th is when his body was found. But he was in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Now, you, of course, James, are from West Virginia. And so you're familiar with that area, if I'm not mistaken.
Very much so. Very much so. So I'm originally from Fayetteville, which is in the southern part of the state. and I went away to college at Shepherd College, which is now known as Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is just a mere 10 minutes away from Martinsburg. So now, I was still in high school in Fayetteville when Danny Casolaro was found dead in a Sheraton Hotel bathtub in 91. But I find the connections of some of the things there in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia kind of interesting that maybe we'll get into here in just a few minutes. But let's continue.
Okay. Now, Casolaro was there to meet some sources. And according to Elliot Richardson, Elliot Richardson is the former attorney general under Richard Nixon. He resigned at the height of Watergate because he refused to fire the special prosecutor. And he was representing the Hamiltons. He was their attorney. And what happened is, in the early 1990s, an Australian program called The Current Affair, an Australian version of The Current Affair, did a segment on Inslaw. And he was interviewed. He was also interviewed for Unsolved Mysteries, which at the time, which in the early 90s, was hosted by Robert Stack. Now, there's a newer version that's on Spike TV that's hosted by Dennis Farina. And that is where I first found out about this case. It was the Unsolved Mysteries segment. This was the early 90s. So, Elliot Richardson was interviewed for not only the Australian A Current Affair, but also for Unsolved Mysteries. And in the current Affair, he stated that Casolaro supposedly had it. And his friends, Casolaro's friends, say that he was close to breaking the story. Meaning I was supposed the octopus. But also probably related to the Inslaw case itself. So he was there in Martinsburg for a very specific reason. And I want people to note that because of what happened after his body was found, or how his death was classified. That's very important to know. Now, here's an interesting thing. Actually, I'll get into the last days, I should say. So, my understanding from Casolaro's last days, at least from what I've read, is that he had one account that I had read is that he had, I believe on the 9th, on August 9th, had been meeting with or was with an individual described by a waitress. He was at a cocktail lounge, I believe, at the hotel. And someone as, quote, Arab or Iranian. Now, I can't go too far about that. I don't have anything beyond what I've been able to, read about that. Now, another aspect that he was, I think, also, if I'm not mistaken, he had also met William Richard Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'd given him some documents, and that was before. So what happened is that Casolaro's body was found on August 10th. That's a Saturday. It was found at, I believe, 12:30 p.m. Now, when Casolaro was found, he was found in room 517 of the Sheraton, I think Martinsburg Inn, I think that's the formal name of it. His body was found in the bathroom. Now, it was a tub that was basically a blood, bloody water. So he's found in a tub of bloody water. There supposedly was not only blood on the floor, which was a tile floor, but also on the wall. The reason why I point this out is that Casolaro's friends and family say that he was squeamish about blood. He didn't even want to get a blood test. He was supposed to get a blood test for which escapes my mind at the point. But he was supposed to get blood tests. He was very squeamish about blood and about blood tests. I think even his brother, Tony, has said this. His brother is a physician. Casolaro's dad was also a doctor. He was an obstetrician, from what I understand.
So they would probably know if he was squeamish about blood.
Yeah. That's one of the strongest things from everything that I've read, even from the profiles on Unsolved Mysteries. People can check out online. and the current affair, which is also online. People can go to YouTube and check those out. And I recommend they do. That's one of the strongest things that emerge is, in terms of the details of Casolaro's life, is that he was squeamish about blood. So, you have a man in a blood-filled tub of water. Blood on the floor and blood on the wall. My understanding is there were also bloody towels that were on the floor. Those were later disposed of, from what I understand. So, Casolaro's body was discovered, I believe, by a maid at the hotel. She called, I think, a maintenance man, and he looked into it, and then they called the police. And they came in. Now, Casolaro's body had about 12 cuts. Or should I say, his arms had 12 cuts. Not his wrist, his arms. I believe there was 8. Let me see here. I think you had 8 on one arm and you had about 4 on the other. At least one of the cuts sliced into the tendon. That means that it went beyond the skin, you know, tendons over the bone, right? So if it sliced beneath the skin and into the tendon, it's a strong cut. So
basically, how would someone that squeamish slash the hell out of themselves so deep they're cutting tendons, you know, right, a dozen times?
Interesting detail number one. Why would somebody who's afraid of blood tests, as you mentioned, squeamish, why would they cut themselves? Why would they commit suicide in such a manner? To me, this is one of the first details, or I call it interesting details, of this case that don't quite jive.
Well, I was going to say, there's also, notes of, you mentioned the towels that almost looked as though someone had kind of, you know how you throw a towel down and use your foot to wipe something up, as if something had been moved around.
Right.
So, basically, the murder scene is completely suspicious.
Well, the official, remember what the police in Martinsburg classified it as, a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
which sounds like something out of Arkansas, where folks die of, you know, laying on train tracks, or, and it's, you know, ruled suicide.
Oh yes.
That's a whole other case.
I'm familiar with that case, and that's a whole other case. But in this case, that's why I mentioned the blood. You have this blood, from what I've read, you had blood, not only bloody water in the tub, but on the floor, the wall. Again, the interesting detail, all these cuts. That's just, so we've got those details. Now then, here's another aspect. The body was found, obviously the police came, they took it away. The body was, I believe, looked over, examined. What happened is the body ended up being embalmed. Now, the body's found on a Saturday. The relatives of Danny Casolaro are informed on Monday. So nearly a couple of days go by. By this time, Danny Casolaro's body, which was, I believe, sent to the Brown Funeral Home in Martinsburg, was embalmed, I believe. So it was embalmed at the Brown Funeral Home. Now here's interesting detail number two. Why is it that a body, which has just recently been not only discovered, but removed from the site of death, supposedly, why would it then be embalmed in less than a couple of days? I mean, this is a violation of West Virginia law. If this was supposedly your average suicide or your average death in a place like Martinsburg or any other place, why would you wait? Why would you rush to embalm? Why would you rush to even mess with the body and preserve it in that sort of state? Why would there be a need for that? The family didn't get permission. fact, they weren't even notified until Monday. By that time, he'd already been involved.
Mm-hmm. And the family, again, has said they found it incomprehensible that he would kill himself this way because he was squeamish.
Right.
And it's this then sounds like cleaning up a crime scene illegally.
Right. See, that's the issue. And here's another point. There was a professional cleaning crew, from what I understand, that went into the hotel and cleaned that room. In the meantime, all of these potential clues, whether it's clues that would lead to suicide or lead to murder, however you want to look at it, they were tossed out, thrown out in the course of this cleaning. They went through the room, they cleaned it. I think John Connolly had mentioned on the original Unsolved Mysteries segment that, and I had read his Spy Magazine investigation into the death of Danny Casolaro, that they had not used the strainer, I believe, to drain the water. When you look at the details of this, it's simply just surprising. And then I haven't even mentioned the so-called suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Let me see. Now, the so-called suicide note, he had basically, there was a, let me see here. There was a page ripped out of a notepad. And this is what it read. At least I can read my notes here. To those who I love the most, please forgive me for the worst possible thing I could have done. Most of all, sorry to my son. I know deep down that God will let me in. Now, my understanding is that Casolaro was not religious and that his style of writing was a bit more on the flowery or wordy side.
Friends have actually described him. He wasn't an investigative journalist. Danny was a poet. And so this last note is very flat and very religious. Yeah, and that last line is, I know deep down inside that God will let me in.
Yes, I know deep down inside that God will let me in. Yeah, interesting detail number three, at least for me. So we have 10 to 12 cuts on his arm, at least one that could sever a tendon. We have the fact that his body was embalmed after it was removed and before his family was notified. And we have his suicide note, which as you clearly state, is written in a kind of flat tone, not befitting someone who is, had far more literary aspirations, obviously, as a writer, than this would imply. And who was supposedly not religious, at least from what I've read. All of this seems to indicate that things are not what they seem, to put it mildly, in this case. And then you have the autopsy, which I believe was performed at the University of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And in the autopsy, my understanding is that I think there was a little alcohol that was found, but you also had antidepressants in Casolaro's system. Now, my understanding is that he had no prescription for these antidepressants. Or at least there hasn't been any evidence that I'm aware of. Nothing's turned up that implies that he was, you know, taking this on prescription. Also, in the autopsy, there was a bruise on his head, and I believe there was also a bruise on his arm. And I also understand that his nails were possibly broken, and according to the Unsolved Mysteries segment, the original one, the tops of his fingers were gone. The tops of at least three fingers on one hand were gone. So like the very, very top, tip top of his fingers, I gather, were gone. So my understanding is that his nails were not examined, looked at for tissue that would indicate whether he had fought anyone or grabbed any skin underneath. Because if you fight someone, perhaps get a good grab,
struggle.
If there was struggle, then grab some skin, right? Nothing like that. Also, he had, so that's another, you could call it interesting detail number four. or details number four. Also the fact that he had supposedly symptoms of multiple sclerosis. And this is seen as a reason for his suicide. Now, it's a plausible reason. I'll grant that. It's a plausible reason. But there's no indication that he exhibited any symptoms of MS, at least at the time that he was alive. And I guess I would call this, it would be, what, interesting detail number five? We have to five now?
Mm-hmm.
So, here we have the death of Danny Casolaro, and I've just mentioned the details. Right?
Well, and I was going to say that we've kind of discussed all the interesting things that were found at the scene, but maybe let's move to what wasn't found at the scene.
Right. His notes. His papers. Supposedly, I think he had packed up a black bag, and black bag had a lot of his notes and his papers. All the notes and papers that he had brought with him to the hotel. That dealt with the octopus, that dealt perhaps maybe with Inns' Law or various aspects of Inns' Law. They were gone. They weren't there in the hotel. And certainly the police said that they didn't know anything about any such papers. They didn't recover any. They weren't there, according to the police. So that's also very significant. That's another very significant detail. His papers were gone. Missing. So that begs the question, you know, obviously, who took them? We don't know. So when you add up all of these factors, it results in a very strange occurrence, to put it mildly. This is very strange.
We also have some of the connections of, and again, this is, you know, what's so fascinating about this is that there's a lot of open source information about this story, and I don't know if we mentioned it on mic or not, about there was a Wired story many, many years ago, I believe called the Inns' Law Octopus. There's
which I've read, yes.
Pieces from the Village Voice and the book put out by Farrell House, which actually I'm holding right here, by Ken Thomas and Jim Keith. Jim Keith, of course, someone else who died under mysterious circumstances. So all of this info is really, you know, is available. And again, the links will be provided. We even have the mention of something about a mysterious sort of military officer showing up to Casolaro's funeral a few days later.
And you could find this on the Unsolved Mysteries original segment. Unsolved Mysteries was originally hosted by Robert Stack, film and TV actor. Mm-hmm. Those of you who've seen Airplane will probably know he starred in that movie, the parody movie. But he was the host for many years. And this is the Danny Casolaro segment that appeared there shows a recreation of a military officer. Somebody was wearing, I guess it would be, you know, with ribbons and everything, walking up, this was during Casolaro's funeral, walking up, putting a ribbon, on, I believe, his grave, on his coffin, saluting, and then heading back to his car. No one, according to that segment, that Unsolved Mystery segment, as reported on Unsolved Mysteries, no one in the family knew who this was.
Mm-hmm. And that sources back to this Village Voice article.
Right.
So,
yeah,
what I'm saying is
James Ridgway.
And Vaughn. Yes.
Yes.
Ridgway,
yes,
and Vaughn article.
Yeah, I've read portions of that. So when you add up all these details, I call them interesting details. The conclusion that you, at least that any reasonable or sane person, it's easy to get insane in this whole affair, that the only conclusion that you have to come up with that something isn't right about this. Now, here's my take on it. I've laid out the details, and James, of course, is also laid out the details. We've both done it. Here's my take on this. Now, those who argue that this was a suicide, I would argue was not. I think it's unlikely that Danny Casolaro decided to head down to Martinsburg, West Virginia, of all places, to go to a hotel room, take a razor blade, or whatever kind of blade was used, cut his arm more than 10 times or more, including cutting down into the tendon, and then allow the blood to flow into a tub in which he was sitting in. Another aspect about Casolaro is he was rather wary about being naked. Obviously, he was in a bathtub, so that's a different story. It's intimate. But he was worried about being naked as well around people. Very interesting. Kind of a minor interesting detail, but it's interesting nonetheless. So is it logical for a guy who's so afraid of blood to do this and to go down to Martinsburg, West Virginia? Now, this is what I understand about Martinsburg, West Virginia, and you can bring up some more facts. I'd like to get your perspective on this, James. Martinsburg, West Virginia has several federal facilities, or facilities relating to agencies of the federal government, like the U.S. Coast Guard, and, of course, the IRS. The IRS has a computing center at Martinsburg, West Virginia. This computing center deals with tax forms relating to businesses and also individuals. But I think businesses are a large part of it. It's no coincidence that Danny Casolaro went to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And if he were going to commit suicide, why couldn't he have done it in Fairfax, Virginia, or anywhere else? Why would he have to go here to commit suicide? It doesn't add up. It does not add up.
And I think we should mention, too, that before he left for Martinsburg, I believe he told someone, you know, I'm going to bring back the head of the octopus. That he felt like the research was coming together, and he was going to Martinsburg to get some final piece, he believed. So why would he say, yeah, you know, my work is going great, and I'm about to, you know, pull it off.
Right.
And he also told his family, you know, if I die under mysterious circumstances, don't believe it was an accident or suicide.
Right. That's very important because he's basically stating something could happen to me. He knows that there have been deaths associated with not only the octopus, but with Inslaw, with the Perlman scandal.
And he was getting threatening, harassing phone calls leading up to that time.
Right. That's the indication. That's what his brother has stated, that he was getting threats from people he didn't know, calling him up and saying that he's going to die. So he clearly knew that there was, my feeling is that Casolaro knew there was danger in going to Martinsburg, West Virginia. And I stress this part about Martinsburg, West Virginia, IRS facility that's there, computing center. I would assume this computing center has been there for quite some time. It was there when Casolaro had gone to Martinsburg, West Virginia. If that's the case, now, here's another interesting aspect, and this is why I'm looking at the IRS. And I believe the IRS, maybe not directly, but the IRS in some way figures into his death. You have the IRS center there, the computing center at Martinsburg, West Virginia. Michael Ricano Sciutto, who was the source for Danny Casolaro, said on the Unsolved Mysteries segment back in the early 90s that Casolaro had a source in the IRS that was providing him with hard copy printups of individuals he's looking at. Targets is the word that Casolaro used. When I look at the fact that Martinsburg has this data center or this computer center, when I look at what Ricano Sciutto said, and you can't take everything that Michael Ricano Sciutto says totally and believe it totally, because I, you know, didn't have any interest in it at first. But then when I, you know, read about Martinsburg, read about this computing center, and I also go back to the fact, and I'm spilling a little beans here about the Promise case, I maybe shouldn't until I get into foreground here, the fact that that one of the procurement officer, a Vidniak, was a former IRS agent. Now, this is a procurement officer for the Department of Justice who was dealing with the contract between between Inslaw and the Department of Justice. Now, this was the contract, the initial contract, to supply Promise to the U.S. Attorney's offices, basically for the Justice Department. So Vidniak, who was the procurement officer for Justice Department at the time, He was a former IRS agent. He was a revenue agent for the IRS. So when I look at all of these aspects, now again,
We've just kind of introduced a couple new characters there with Michael Riconosciuto,
right,
and also Vidniak, and what's the first name?
Let me see if I have the first name here. I've got my notes right in front of me. Peter Vidniak, I believe is his
Peter
name.
Vidniak.
Yeah. He's kind of bounced around. Well, like I said, I'll get a little into him.
Mm-hmm.
But, so that's the connection that that's what interests me about this. And I don't know who's written about this thus far, who's looked into it. But the IRS aspect is interesting to me.
Well, and what I'll then say, I never lived in Martinsburg, which is
right.
In Berkeley County in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. But I went to school in Shepherdstown at Shepherd University for 10 years. I lived there from 95 to 2005. Shepherdstown is in Jefferson County, but again, 10 minutes away from Martinsburg. What started to dawn on me, and this was just right around the turn of the millennium, the first week of 2000, Shepherdstown and Shepherd University specifically hosted Israeli-Syrian peace talks with Bill Clinton. And so it brought this amazing event to our little small town, and there were stories of, Israeli agents driving around with jamming equipment so that, the Syrians, couldn't communicate as well, just to kind of screw up the process. And there was one night I know I was closing down at the movie theater, appropriately enough, that I worked at, and, locking the door and looking overhead and seeing this big helicopter fly over and, there goes the president. So when an event like that came to Shepherdstown, it really started to make me think, why would they do it here? Of course, the obvious reason is, it's an hour away from D.C., so it's just enough away, but still close that it's not a big, huge travel. They can get back to D.C. and with the quickness, on helicopters and things. But the facilities that housed these peace talks had only recently been built, and a lot of this took place in something called the Clarion Inn, which, is a part, I believe, of just sort of the franchise of, Comfort Inn and Clarion Inn and Sleep Inn. But a lot of those places are sort of, independently owned, franchises. This place had been built just outside of the town limits in Shepherdstown, and it really kind of, I guess, piqued my curiosity when these peace talks came to this facility that had just been built as a hotel for the public. But, going by, friends that have worked there and do work there, there are places that you can't go and you're not allowed to go. And they'll sometimes host sort of, military meetings and things, And what really got me thinking about it was, I don't know if you're familiar with the Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia.
Sounds familiar.
In Lewisburg, it was basically a Cold War era bunker. It was a sort of, it was the West Virginia White House, basically. So if something would happen in D.C., this was their continuity of government, one of their underground structures. So as the Cold War wore on and, the place basically got to the point where if something happened, it couldn't have really facilitated, a new secret government. And a Washington Post, I think some journalists there, basically were going to blow the whole story. And they basically, I think before they ran the story, went to the Greenbrier and said, hey, we're about to blow you guys out of the water and put it on the front of the magazine. So we're telling you now to give you the chance to come out and say, yes, the Greenbrier Hotel has been a Cold War bunker all these years, but now it's not anymore. And you can go and it's a museum and you can tour through it and things. But the connections that started to come in Shepherdstown, and I feel like after those peace talks happened in 2000, a lot of other government facilities, there's a Fish and Wildlife Center that's called the NCTC, which is funny because it's the National Conservation Training Center, but one of the other alphabet agencies, NCTC, is the National Counterterrorism Center. And all these places just started to spring up that, again, I think there is and has been a big kind of spook infestation into Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
I'm not really surprised. This is fascinating to me. This is interesting. When I read about Martinsburg, I read about the IRS Center. I heard what Reconosciuto had to say. Again, you know, you've got to take what he says. With characters like that, you have to say that half of what he's saying is probably true and half of it is probably untrue. And then when I look at the fact that this procurement officer for the Department of Justice, which was working on this contract between DOJ, Justice Department, and Inslaw, was a former IRS agent. The IRS, I think there's a definite IRS connection. Now again, I'm not saying the IRS, you know, is necessarily insinuated into the octopus.
No, and I think like a lot of the things in, you know, quote-unquote conspiracy research, we're not saying the IRS is in on it. My aunt that works for the IRS isn't a part of this scheme. I think like a lot of the other elements, and what we're even talking about the octopus, is that you have rogue elements within banking and military and politics and government.
Right.
Rogue elements who, you know, owe no allegiance to no country or no religion. They are families. They're essentially gangsters, and I've called them multi-generational serial killers. These are the families in the organization. So again, it's not, you know, it's not your uncle that works for the IRS that's in on it.
But what's interesting to me, of course, is the fact if Reconosciuto is true about what he says, and that he did have a source in the IRS, it would make a lot of sense for him to be in Martinsburg if this facility was open at the time. If this facility was open, mm-hmm. The computing center was there at the time.
There's a biometrics, a sort of forensics lab that is in West Virginia, one of the kind of the leaders in biometrics. So West Virginia, and that's what I've always found fascinating, you know, I was born and raised there, is that on the one hand, it's a completely unknown state. So there are times, you know, when I mention that I'm from West Virginia while here in Oregon, you know, you get the response of, oh, I know some people in Roanoke. Like, that's Virginia,
that's
you know.
Virginia.
But when you start to delve into it, you do find all these amazing, you know, and we're not going to go there, but you have the
right.
Sort of Mothman connections and Charles Manson
yeah.
and the, you know, Moundsville and the penitentiaries and all of those things that, again, I think, you know, later when I have more time, I do want to go into sort of the alternative history and conspiracies surrounding West Virginia. But please continue.
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting. As I don't recall if I mentioned this at the beginning, but I believe I did. But my view of the whole Inslaw and Promise scandals relates to what I call the secret history of the United States, which is a history we don't see in textbooks and we don't see on TV and we don't see in movies. But I think that Inslaw and Promise is part of what I call the spy. Promise is part of what I call the spy state. And by spy state, what I mean is the national security framework, the intelligence infrastructure that has been built since the post-war period, with the formation of the Alphabet Intelligence Agency, or Alphabet agencies like the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, and so on and so forth.
All those things that spilled out of the National Security Act of 1947.
Yeah. Right. Precisely. So why is, I'll get into this, I guess we should wrap up the Dana Castellaro part.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'll get into is my belief is, and this is what I'm seeing in terms of my thesis, my belief is that Promise is part of what I call the spy state, which is this intelligence apparatus. And so what it is it's a vital component, so like the second wave, because Promise, I believe, was very important. It was important enough for the DOJ to want to ruin Inslaw. It was important enough for them to basically pirate the software.
So
it was.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was going to say, so if we basically have an investigative journalist close, or at least he believed close to wrapping up this investigation, but winds up suspiciously dead, chasing after something that again, with all its connections to banking and military and all that, comes down to basically a piece of software called Promise. So let's talk maybe about what this software was and is.
Well, Promise, as you mentioned before, is Prosecutor's Management Information System. Now, according to the House Judiciary Committee's report on the INFLAW hearings, this is, for those who want to look it up, it's report 102-857, the 102nd Congress, second session. And this is a quote from the report. Promise was, quote, designed to meet the criminal prosecutor workloads of large urban jurisdictions. Now, why is Promise so fascinating or so interesting or so important?
Because that description sounds pretty boring.
Yeah, it sounds bland. Yeah, you're right. It does seem bland. Now, in looking at James Ridgway's article, I think it's the, I think his article for, it was Village Voice, I believe.
If there's the James Ridgway and Doug Vaughn article called The Last Days of Danny Casolaro that was published in the Village Voice, October 15th, 1991.
Correct. Now, I think he also wrote, I don't know if he also wrote another article on the INFLAW software scam or scandal. Now, what INFLAW is interesting in that it not only basically, as I mentioned, what INFLAW could do was it could keep track of cases, it could keep track of defendants, it could keep track of attorneys. Not only that, but my understanding is it could follow the history of an investigation, according to James Ridgway, a history down to the most recent police report, or detective's most recent report. So this software system was a bit of a breakthrough, I would say. Now, Promise, and this has to be really, I want to make sure that I emphasize this to people. What do I mean by Promise? There are actually two versions of Promise. The first version was developed by, as I mentioned, William Hamilton. And as we had mentioned before, his company, it was a non-profit company, or non-profit organization called the Institute for Law and Social Research. And this was founded in the early 70s, 1974, if I'm not mistaken. Now, basically, they developed Promise, however you want to state it, a Promise, due to grants from the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. Now, was an agency within the Justice Department. It's no longer around. So, the federal government provided the seed money, the funding to create Promise, to basically fund Promise. Basically, it came from the federal government. So what happened is, by 1981, the LEAA was eliminated. So what happened is that Hamilton and his wife Nancy, they decided to turn INFLAW into a for-profit company. So it went from not-for-profit to for-profit in 1981 or so. And the express purpose, of course, was to market Promise, and its subsidiary software programs. So that was the main function. Now, I mentioned before that Promise was developed by the LEAA, was developed under funding from the LEAA, which was an agency of the Department of Justice, or Justice Department. Basically, it was funded by the federal government. What happened is that Hamilton came out with another version, which is known in the Judiciary Committee report and elsewhere as Enhanced Promise, or Promise 82. For our purposes, why don't we just call this Promise 2.0, and the original will be Promise 1.0. Hopefully that'll make it a lot simpler. So Hamilton develops Promise 2.0. And this is so the Justice Department wants this version. This is the version that they basically tried to destroy INFLAW over. It was Promise 2.0 or Enhanced Promise. So, what happened is that the Justice Department and InsLaw conclude a contract. This contract was worth about $10 million. I've seen some sources to be 9.6, but generally I'll go with 10 because that was in the Congressional Committee report. And this was a 3-year contract. And this would basically have Promise installed at a number of U.S. attorneys' offices. Now, before the LEAA was dismantled or eliminated, Promise was at a couple of U.S. attorneys' offices, so it was already up and running. So it was basically on a pilot or test basis, and it was being used and run. Now, what happened was, in 1983, the contract was modified. So in 1982, March of 1982, Justice Department awards InsLaw the contract. 1983, the contract's modified. And what happens is the Justice Department agrees to pay to pay licensing fees to InsLaw. Because they admit that, that they have, you know, those rights, basically. So that's a part of what you see with software programs. You know, you have to pay licensing fees for the software program. What happens, though, is that afterwards, Justice withholds payments from InsLaw. Now, InsLaw tried, you know, to resolve the matter, tried to negotiate. Justice didn't want to negotiate. They stonewalled. So by February 1985, InsLaw was forced to go into bankruptcy. Now, my understanding is that the Justice Department withheld about $1.6 million. That's a figure that keeps cropping up. Well, at least it was over $1 million. Let's just agree to that. So, InsLaw is forced into bankruptcy by 1985. But they didn't just want InsLaw to go into just bankruptcy. They wanted them eliminated. Basically, what they want is InsLaw to go from Chapter 11 bankruptcy to Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Chapter 11 is reorganization, the common bankruptcy that most people have heard about or they know. It basically allows a company or an entity to basically organize themselves fiscally in regards to dealing with their debts, expenditures, all kinds of outstanding monies or financial issues that they have, and, of course, the assets contained therein. Chapter 7 is liquidation. That basically means that it's turned over to a trustee. That trustee basically decides if your company is going to remain open for any amount of time. But it means that all your assets, most of your major assets, or basically all your assets, basically get liquidated. They basically get put up for sold, for sale, or auction.
Just so you can try and basically break. Not even break even, but so you can settle all your outstanding debts. But it kills the company.
Right. It does. See, if they forced InsLaw to Chapter 7 bankruptcy, what does that mean?
They don't even exist anymore.
Correct. But more importantly,
well,
Promise gets sold. See, that's what they wanted. They wanted enhanced Promise. Now, here's the weird part. Now, here's the interesting part. The Promise 2.0 was actually, there was a firm that was interested in buying this Promise 2.0. The firm is Hadron Incorporated. Hadron Incorporated is controlled by Biotech Capital Corporation, which is also known as Infotech, I think is another name for it, is Infotech. And that was, that had as its president and chair a man by the name of Dr. Earl Bryan. Now, who's Earl Bryan? Dr. Earl Bryan was a combat surgeon in Vietnam. He served in Vietnam. My understanding is he may have been involved in aspects of Operation Phoenix, or at least tied to a unit that dealt with it. I'm not quite sure. That's one aspect.
Operation Phoenix being an assassination program in Vietnam War.
Precisely. So Brian was involved in Hadron Incorporated. Obviously, that was his company, through Biotech Capital Corporation, or Infotech. Now, Brian had served in the Reagan administration in California when Ronald Reagan was governor in, the late 60s, in the 60s or so, getting into 70s. So he was part of the Reagan administration in California. Now, he had served in a, he was the Secretary of Health and Welfare under that administration. And he quit to run for senator, I believe, against Alan Cranston, but he lost. So when Reagan got to the White House, he was on the task force for health care reduction. It was kind of an unpaid gig for him. Now, Earl Brian figures into this. And any, like, for example, if you're taking a look at the Australian A Current Affair segment, you'll find Brian's name up there. You'll see a picture of Earl Brian. The reason why he's involved in this whole affair is not only because Hadron Incorporated was involved in trying to buy the software, but because Earl Brian himself has ties to Republican players. Ronald Reagan is one. Another is Ed Meese, who was Attorney General under Ronald Reagan. In fact, I believe Meese's wife had some interest in Hadron or some of Brian's companies. Now, Brian himself, it's interesting because he, from what I've read, Brian himself was involved in some other stolen materials, tapes that involved the names of people on welfare in California, I believe. Now, Earl Brian, his name, according to those who've written extensively about the, not only the Octopus, but about the Enslaw affair, Brian himself is tied to the October surprise scandal. And the belief is, this is the belief as brought out by numerous writers, the belief is that Earl Brian was involved in helping to broker the deals that allowed the October surprise scandal, or basically October surprise, for those who aren't aware of it, that basically involved members of the then Reagan, Ronald Reagan campaign, who was supposedly meeting in secret with Iranian officials. And the intent of this was to make sure that the hostages that were held by Iran, Iran had stormed the U.S. embassy in the late 70s. This is when the Shah of Iran was ousted by Islamists, or basically elements that were loyal to the religious leader Ayatollah Khomeini.
Mm-hmm. And of course, all the other intelligence connections that has on its own.
Oh, jeez. So they took over the U.S. embassies. A bunch of students rushed over the walls of the U.S. embassy, basically took hostages, the remaining members of the U.S. embassy there in Iran. And these hostages were held for a number of months, like over a year. And basically what the Reagan campaign team, if it is believed, in regards to the October, supposedly what these officials from the Reagan campaign, in terms of meeting with the Iranian officials, were ironing out, was a deal that would keep the hostages back in Iran, kept them held until the Reagan campaign won the 1980 election. And after that election, the hostages would be released.
Mm-hmm. So that in this campaign in 1980, so we're talking about, and that's why it's called the October Surprise, because it's right before the November election in 1980, Jimmy Carter was weak and looked even weaker because he couldn't get these hostages out of Iran. The Reagan team was saying, we're tough, we'll get those hostages back. Meanwhile, they were wheeling and dealing to make sure the hostages didn't come out before the election, thereby helping Jimmy Carter, because he would have been able to claim sort of victory there.
Right, absolutely. And the whole point, the reason why it's called October Surprise, was the fear that if Carter was able to negotiate passage for the hostages out of Iran, and if he was able to get them released, that it would prove to be the surprise for the Reagan campaign, that he would engineer a way to get the Oscars out, and that would improve his standings in the polls and lead to him being reelected.
Mm-hmm. And
so that
now,
was the fear.
And the term October surprise has now come to mean sort of any kind of shady game changer in the days leading up to a presidential election.
Right, right. Now, according to... Now, the October surprise is not considered to be an official scandal. That is not considered official. So I have to emphasize that. October surprise is considered to be a discredited account, supposedly. Even though, of all the supposed conspiracies that are out there, this is one of the most logical ones that there is. It makes absolute sense. And we know that in 1968, that Richard Nixon told South Vietnamese officials, or tried to get South Vietnamese officials to hold off on peace talks with the North Vietnamese in order to get a better deal from Nixon, who was then running for president against Hubert Humphrey. So we know that that occurred.
Mm-hmm. So why, exactly, that we've seen it throughout history, so why
right.
have
so
we
why
not?
So why isn't it feasible that October surprise could happen? But that's, you know, that's as it is.
So, if we can maybe jump back to the enhanced right. promise, the new
right.
and updated version, what did this new updated version have, and what makes this so powerful?
It's interesting. Now, my understanding from what I've read is that the American and the British navies were conducting tests on software, on any software programs or any types of computer programs that could track Soviet subs. This was, I think, about 1983 or something. It was in the early 80s. And they were using various types of programs, and they used PROMIS. And when they used PROMIS, or PROMIS, as some would call it, PROMIS worked. So that gets into the a little into the intelligence community. You argue what was so good about it. Well, this is where Michael Reconosciuto comes in. Now, I mentioned him before. Michael Reconosciuto was called by the committee, the Judiciary Committee, a shady character. They use that exact quote. The last I heard of Reconosciuto, he was in jail. He was in prison on drug charges in Seattle, or in Washington State. Reconosciuto was a source of Casolaro. And basically, Reconosciuto has said that he took the PROMIS software, and he installed a backdoor. This backdoor would basically allow any party or entity that had the right access code to read any of the software that this system was on. So the other software, all the other facets of the computer system that PROMIS was entered on, it could read that. What does this mean? It means essentially that this can be used as, in essence, a bug. Some people use the term Trojan horse. I use like the term bug. Well, when you bug a house or you bug a room, what are you doing? You're putting a tiny electronic microphone and receiver for sound into a lampshade or any other part, and you're listening to conversations. In the case of PROMIS, with this backdoor that Reconosciuto says he installed in the software, this would allow any agency or any party access to whatever is on their operating systems, on their software, what have you. So you're talking about in the early 80s, this is like a license to spy. That's why I say mm-hmm. that PROMIS is important when we talk about the spy state that the U.S. has become.
It will, and I think we'll probably get to that as it extrapolates out wider and wider. So we're talking about basically cutting edge, amazing software that gave people real-time overviews of attorneys and police administrations and other just government agencies, non-governmental agencies. You could sell this as a great thing to these people that they wanted this amazing software, but it came with a backdoor that let the information leak out, essentially, or that gave the spooks the access.
Right. you could read it when you had the right access code. You could get into this trapdoor and you could read whatever information was there. And Bill Hamilton said on the Australian Current Affairs segment that was done in the 1990s, he mentioned in this interview that what Promise did was it categorized, it was equivalent to, with the backdoor, was equivalent to reading handwritten notes or written notes. The difference is, with Promise, you could categorize and index these. So it was kind of neat and organized. Another interesting aspect of the Promise software. So clearly, this software was seen as beyond beneficial.
And it was, like I said, basically used to spy on the good guys and the bad guys, or whoever the gray area in between is.
Correct. That's what we're getting into here. See, this is why the Department of Justice was so interested in this. Now, Reconosciuto says that he was given this Promise software by Earl Bryan. Reconosciuto says, in fact, that he and Earl Bryan had paid the Iranians $40 million during the whole surprise October surprise scandal. That's his contention, that he paid. In any event, Reconosciuto, who says that he was a director or research director at the Cabazon Indian Reservation in India, said that Bryan had visited this locale.
Well, and that's Indio, California.
California, right. And in Indio, California, the Cabazon Indian Reservation. Now, he said that Bryan had given him this software and to install, and that a lot of the modifications, most of the modifications, the backdoor modifications, were done on, at Indio, California, on the reservation itself. Now, this is significant because the reservation would be pretty much sovereign territory, sovereign land. It wouldn't have federal oversight. In other words, it wouldn't be under the jurisdiction of the federal government.
Mm-hmm. It's essentially a sort of no man's land.
Right. Well, see, with a number of Native American tribes and Native American nations, I should say, basically some of these reservations or some of these tribal areas would be considered sovereign territory. So you wouldn't be applicable. If you're there, you're applicable to tribal laws, not to federal laws or even possibly state laws.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, of course, this is deliberate, right? If Reconosciuto is right, and if he says he installed the backdoor for Promise on the Cabazon Indian Reservation, then...
Well, and I think we tie in here at the Cabazon Reservation in Indio, California, we tie in the private security company formerly known as Wagon Hut.
Right.
I think everybody is probably familiar with that name, whether you've seen them as whether it's, you know, the rent-a-cop downtown, but it goes much, 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 much higher, and they, like many other shady private, you know, military contractors and such, change their names, and I think they're now known as the Geo Group. So just to keep that straight. And I do have one other thing about Indio, California, unless you have other things that you want to speak about right there.
No. Well, let's hear what let's get into your take.
But it's always interesting to bring in the sort of media, mass media, pop culture connections.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what goes on every spring in Indio, California?
Not off the top of my head.
There is a massive weekend, amazing concert that pretty much has, you know, it's coming up here in actually just a few short weeks in April. It's called Coachella. It's a huge music festival on par with some of the bigger ones around the world. Perhaps the UK does, the Glastonbury Fest or the Reading Festival. Massive, right. You know, tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of people. I'd love to go to it. It's just too ridiculously expensive, and it has a lot of the best, you know, kind of new bands in the world. But to have this happening on a former, you know, Indian land, and private military, you know, area, I find just another fascinating connection to that we find things a lot of times built on Indian grounds, and a lot of times those are either prisons or military bases. But here you have a sort of somewhat, not counterculture, but it's a slightly, you know, alternative, albeit massively big budget concert affair. So I find it interesting that you have, you know, a rockin' music festival on this, you know, interesting land.
Right. Well, that's an interesting little wrinkle there. I've heard of Coachella, but I didn't know too much about it. But it is an interesting little wrinkle there. Interesting about the whole Indio connection, as you mentioned, the corporation formerly known as Lackinac, and the Cabazon Indian Reservation. This was investigated by a reporter named Nathan Baca for a station called KESQ. I'm getting ahead of myself here. KESQ in California. He did a multiple part investigation into at least three murders that were tied with the Cabazon Indian Reservation. The vice chair of the reservation was killed along with his friend and the friend's girlfriend. And Baca had been investigating that. I believe they have someone in custody over those murders. But he had investigated that, and of course, in the course of his investigation, he dealt with, to a certain extent, the whole Inflaw scandal, because it's tied in due to what Michael Reconosciuto has said, you know, about his work on the Promise software at the Cabazon Indian Reservation in Indio, California. So that's an interesting, if people want to check out that investigation, it's well worth doing. And checking out that aspect in regards to Indio, California and the Cabazon Indian Reservation. Now, of course, as you mentioned before, Wackenhut and Cabazon had an agreement, basically, to develop various types of weapons for military weapons. There was a number of things, I think, you were talking about, that I looked into or that I read about. There were a number of things that I think they were working on or that were involved. I think night vision goggles were one. I know weapons were another aspect of that. And testing of weapons on Native American soil there on the reservation. So you have that connection as well. And Reconosciuto supposedly said he was the director of research in regards to the reservation, or involved with that. So again, I'm trying not to get into a lot of these other areas that will take you in down into another slide, you know, that leads into God knows where, you know. I'm trying not to do that, but it's hard when I talk about this not to like bring up at least these other.
Well, and I think we are now kind of going chronologically. You know, after we discussed and set the table with the story and the situation of Danny Casolaro's death, and then going to the October surprise and the development of this software, so we're basically in the sort of early 80s. As we move into the Reagan 80s, we have to tie in the Iran-Contra scandals and the BCCI banking fiasco. As we move through time a little bit.
Right. Well, that's what Danny Casolaro was working on. That was the octopus. That's what he had moved from the Inslaw scandal, involving the Hamiltons, involving the Justice Department, to the octopus. And so just to sort of wrap up the octopus, as I mentioned before. The octopus involves a number of scandals in the 80s. Iran-Contra, BCCI, and October Surprise. And as I mentioned before, the basic elements in the head of the octopus, as I call it, are a combination of intelligence veterans or intelligence officials, U.S. officials, and organized crime figures. Now, Reconosciuto is one source, obviously, as I mentioned, Michael Reconosciuto. Another source, or another person that Castellaro talked to, was a guy called Robert Booth Nichols. And that's where kind of the crime element, I think, in this story, or at least partly, comes from, to a certain extent. Because Booth was, Nichols was investigated by the FBI, an agent named Thomas Gates, for his ties to organized crime. Supposedly he was tied to the Japanese Yakuza and as well as the Gambino crime family. Nichols himself was a friend of the actor Steven Seagal. In fact, he had a small role in the movie Under Siege. Nichols himself, interestingly enough, he worked for a guy called Harold Okimoto, who's based here in Hawaii, actually. He was a vice president of a security firm. Interestingly enough, Nichols started a company called Meridian International Logistics. And one of the directors of MIL was Harold Okimoto. Okimoto was believed to have ties to the Yakuza. You have ties with Japanese organized crime. So you've got that element, Robert Booth Nichols. In fact, my understanding is that he called Nichols about 15 times during 1 month, in the summer of, I believe, 1991. So you have Robert Booth Nichols also as a source, or at least a person that Castellaro talked to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to jump back to the whole Inslaw affair, because it's important to get to finish that up. Now, as I mentioned before, Inslaw had this contract with the Justice Department in 1982. It was a 3-year contract worth about $10 million. Basically, after about a year, the Justice Department withholds funding, withholds monies from Inslaw. They don't compensate them. And they're forced into bankruptcy. And what happens is that they wanted to force Inslaw into, as I mentioned before, Chapter 7 liquidation, as opposed to Chapter 11, which is reorganization. Now, this case initially went to bankruptcy court, U.S. bankruptcy court, and there was a judge there by the name of George Basin. And Basin ruled in favor of the Hamiltons because he felt it was what the Justice Department had done was flat out wrong. I mean, basically he felt that they were trying to force the Hamiltons to bankruptcy, and they had not tried to resolve the issue. It was very clear that they were trying to get their hands on the software, and they were just basically stonewalling and not basically doing what they should have done, which is pay the contract, which is a 3-year contract. And basically, I believe Basin had ordered the Justice Department to pay about $6.8 million. So he found, as I mentioned before, in the Hamiltons' favor. Now, this was taken to, I believe, district court, and that was basically affirmed by district court. Affirmed district court. There were some other rulings as well that took place later on. In fact, there was a ruling in 1997 that basically said that the government had the rights to PROMIS. Now, I mentioned before that PROMIS was originally developed by the U.S. government. So the original version 1.0 was developed by the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
What the government didn't have, technically, really, were the rights to enhanced PROMIS. Because that was developed as under Inslaw Inc., which was a private company. So it was really developed as proprietary software. was not developed under the public domain, even though the initial promise was, because it was funded by the LEAA, basically funded by the federal government. So this is my take on the whole promise affair. This is my view. Well, before I get to that, let me just state that Sam Nunn in the Senate investigated the whole Inslaw affair, the whole Inslaw case. And there was also an investigation in the House, as I mentioned before, the House Judiciary Committee under Jack Brooks of Texas.
And that's an interesting name to bring up, because the, you know, the one thing that I know about Jack Brooks is there is a, you know, legendary clip out there of during the Iran-Contra hearings of Jack Brooks asking Oliver North about his involvement in things called Rex 84, Readiness Exercise 1984, and right. also continuity of government drills, that basically practicing the idea of what happens if D.C. gets decapitated, and do they go to, you know, aforementioned underground bunkers, perhaps in West Virginia. So you have Jack Brooks asking Oliver North in these hearings, were you not involved in one time in the implementation of continuity of government exercises that would have overturned the U.S. Constitution and essentially in instituted martial law? The gavel starts to hammer, and Daniel Inouye, who was from Hawaii, correct? And he's still around, right?
Right. Yep.
He basically, on the one hand, you know, looks like, you know, a good guy and has done good things both before and since. But when Jack Brooks brings up, you know, continuity of government drills, he puts an end to it and says, we're not going to talk about that here. End of story. And that's it. So seeing Jack Brooks pop up in the investigation of the Inslaw affair is interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's interesting you bring up Daniel Inouye, who was quoted as saying during the Iran-Contra scandal, during that time, during those hearings, that the U.S. had a secret government. I think that was a quote that he used. Had its own army, navy, air force. And that's very important. Again, we get into the aspect of what I call the spy state. The ability of the United States to project its intelligence capabilities in such a way as to spy on friends, neighbors, and enemies. Promise, I think, is a great part of that. I think it's a very important parcel of that. And that's why it was so important. We talked about some of the features of Promise, and we talked about the fact that the belief was that it was modified with this backdoor that would allow intelligence agency, perhaps, no perhaps about it, I think, but let's just say perhaps, to read what the other programming, the other files, all the other aspects of a person's intelligence agency's operating system, of their software, of whatever is on their mainframes, on their computers.
So, as we maybe start to wrap it up here slowly, there's a very recent story, and I just now thought of this. This wasn't in my, you know, show prep notes or anything, that there was going to be an Israeli operation recently. And I forget exactly, you know, where the IDF was going to go in and, you know, clean up, quote unquote. But they had to call off the entire operation because one guy put something about it on his Facebook page. So you have a guy putting something out essentially in the public on a website that stops armies in its tracks, basically. So if that can happen in the light of day, just think about what can happen behind the scenes and in these backdoor, trapdoor, Trojan-fixed bits of software. So we're almost turning in right now to, not turning into, but we're going to move into something that sounds like an action film, an espionage film. We have super surveillance software that can spy on the good guys and the bad guys alike and all the gray areas in between. It's essentially stolen from the people who made it.
Yeah.
And then where does this software go? Let's take it to now to that level of who got a hold of this software, Promise.
Right. Now, here's the interesting thing. The Department of Justice wanted the enhanced Promise, or Promise 2.0 as I call it. What appears to have happened is that the Justice Department pirated the software. They just went ahead and pirated the software. And my understanding is that the Justice Department not only pirated the software, but they basically gave it to the CIA, which, and the CIA began to sell it to other intelligence agencies. So basically, it was either the Justice Department, the DOJ, or the CIA that not only took pirated Promise and probably had the backdoor installed, or made sure that the backdoor was installed on this program, on the software. But they started selling it to other countries. Canada is one country. I believe the Royal Canadian Mounted Police got a copy of Promis, as well as their intelligence service. You also had Israel. Israel supposedly got their hands on the Promis. Now, Ari Ben Menashe, who is a former Israeli intelligence agent, he was interviewed in the Australian A Current Affair segment, which people can catch on YouTube. He says that Israel knew about this trapdoor and knew about the features of Promis, and it was fine. My understanding from what I've read is that there was a demonstration of Promis that was held in 1983. It was held in 1983, and this was about the time that the contract was modified, right? In 1983, the contract between Justice Department and INSLA. So this test was done. I mentioned before what I read about American and British navies using different kinds of programs to test tracking on Soviet subs, and Promis succeeded. So you see all these elements begin to emerge, right? Israelis, you see Promis being demonstrated to the Israelis. The American and British navies find that Promis was excellent in being able to track and locate or modified to use the track and locate Soviet submarines in the North Atlantic. We see that the Justice Department essentially, pirated the software, which is a violation of law. They broke the law. They pirated the software, and they made sure that other intelligence agencies, like the CIA, would sell the software. That's where Earl Bryan comes in, because the belief with Earl Bryan is that Earl Bryan was a conduit to selling the software. In fact, Earl Bryan's company, Hadron Inc., I believe, tried to buy the software from, buy the software, meaning Enhanced Promise, from INSLA. And Hamilton turned them down. So what we have is the software now being used by intelligence agencies.
Worldwide.
Like worldwide, because it's being sold to Canada. In fact, my understanding is that like 900 different areas in Canada, offices and so forth, were using Promis. Now, the thing is that the Hamiltons found out, the Hamiltons, meaning the owners of INSLA, they found out that it was being sold to Canada. Their daughter was working for the company, and she found out about it. So they knew it was sold to Canada. They had not sold it. So this was proprietary software, essentially, that was stolen by the U.S. government, by the Justice Department, and used by other U.S. intelligence agencies. Not just used by them, but sold to other countries. Countries like Canada. Countries like Israel. There's a belief that Iraq may have had it. Right?
Mm-hmm. And I was
various,
I was going to tie in another character, someone by the name of Robert Hansen. Now,
right. Now, that's another interesting wrinkle. In Nathan Baca's investigation on station KESQ, his investigation into the Cabazon Indian Reservation murders and, of course, INSLA, he notes that Robert Hansen was believed to have sold a version of Promis to his Soviet handler,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he was selling for the Soviet Union.
Now, of course,
that version.
Well, and we should mention that this story has now been turned into a major motion picture starring Chris Cooper and Ryan Phillippe and Laura Linney called Breach.
Right. Reach, right. It's about Hanson's case. Mm-hmm. It was also done as a TV movie, I believe, starring William Hurt.
Yep, Master Spy is what that's called. Now, nowhere, I haven't watched all of Master Spy, but in Breach, there is no reference whatsoever to Promise Software.
Right. There isn't that I can remember, but it's interesting that Hanson was believed to have sold the software. And I should also note this about Promise. I should also note that this would not necessarily be called Promise. That there may be different names, different titles attached to the software. And it's probably been modified over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably, you have probably not just 1.0 and 2.0, but 3.0, 4.0, 5.0, who knows? Maybe there's a Promise 7. Who knows? So this software has to have been modified over the years. And if it is true that Hanson sold this to his backers, to his handlers, to the Soviets, well, to the Russians, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And if that fell into the hands of Osama bin Laden, which is what the belief was, this is another interesting wrinkle in this case. That's why I think it's important when we look at the whole Promise scandal, why this is so important. Because it gets into what I call the spy state, the national security apparatus of the United States, what this country security network has evolved into since the post-war era. And I think it's an important part of that secret history, that black history, you could call it, and of the United States. That's why I think Promise is so important. And really why we haven't probably heard a lot about it. It's not like people can't read about it on the internet, but it certainly isn't in the public consciousness. It certainly isn't in the media consciousness. Even someone like Michelle Malkin, who's a conservative columnist, even she noted that the Hamilton should be compensated for Promise. Even someone like Michelle Malkin said that. And let me just mention what Basin noted. This was the bankruptcy judge. This is what he stated. The Department of Justice took, converted, stole in-flaw software by trickery, fraud, and deceit. The Justice Department engaged in an outrageous, deceitful, fraudulent game of cat and mouse, demonstrating contempt for both the law and any principle of fair dealing. This was George Basin, who was the bankruptcy judge who filed, who ruled in favor of the Hamiltons and urged the Department of Justice to give the Hamiltons $6.8 million. Of course, Basin's reappointment to the federal bankruptcy bench was blocked, and so he was not made a judge again. He could not remain a judge. The person who was named to the bench, however, in federal bankruptcy court was Martin Thiel. Now, who's Martin Thiel? Martin Thiel is the guy who argued the case in front of Basin. So he's the guy who argued the case for Justice Department. He gets to be the bankruptcy judge.
I think what we then see is we've kind of pulled it all the way out now, and I believe you did mention Saddam Hussein, or did you also mention Osama bin Laden?
Well, I mentioned Osama bin Laden, but there was the belief, there is the aspect that Iraq had either Promise or elements of Promise. Versions of it. A Promise, whatever the name was, Promise or called something else. Now, the reason why the Australian Current Affair looked into this is because the Australian Intelligence Agency, ASIO, supposedly got Promise and supposedly purchased it, or they obtained it. That's why they went to the trouble of interviewing Michael Reconosciuto. Reconosciuto says that he modified the software for ASIO. Again, people can take a look at this. I believe that Rachel Begley, who is the daughter of one of the men who was killed in, I believe it was 1981, in Indio, California. He was the vice chair of the Cabazon Indian tribe, especially of the reservation. He was killed, as I mentioned, along with his friend and the friend's girlfriend. She has, I think, a YouTube page, Desert Faye, I believe it is. People can check it out there. I believe she has the whole the Insloss segment on Australian Occurrence Fair. And I think she also has the Unsolved Mystery segment as well, the original Unsolved Mystery segment from the early 90s. Unsolved Mysteries was, as I mentioned before, hosted by Robert Stack. So people can check it out there. So,
well, when you just mentioned ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, and when you said that, it immediately rang a bell that I had just recently posted a headline to MediaMonarchy.com from The Age out of Australia, ASIO in fresh Israel spy probe, and this is February 27th, 2010. ASIO is investigating at least three dual Australian-Israeli citizens whom it suspects of using Australian cover to spy for Israel. And that's, so that's just a week ago.
Yeah. Well,
so these,
you know,
everything kind of, if we're talking about something that has its roots, you know, at the very least in the late 70s and early 80s, as we were talking about, it reverberates, you know, to this very day.
Right.
And if we have, you know, the possibility that, you know, Osama bin Laden had some kind of version of promise, did that let him evade capture? And is that how he's able to run around? I would posit that in this world of, you know, good guys and bad guys and white hats and black hats, that a lot of times I think you have double and triple agents, that you have people who don't really know who they're working for. So they may be terrorists, quote unquote, thinking they're doing it for, you know, the jihad. But when you pull back and you see where funding and armaments and all those connections kind of tie in, it becomes a much more murky situation. So this ultimately ties into, I think, into 9/11. And there's also a piece of self and a company basically called PTECH. P-T-E-C-H. This is, maybe look at this as kind of the flip side in a way of promise, as if, you know, promise was something coming out of America that let, you know, the West spy on everyone else. PTECH is basically a software company that does essentially the same thing, a real-time, almost AI, you know, 21st century software that gives you a real-time overview of, you know, military operations, stock markets, you know, arrests, movements. And PTECH was on FAA, DOD, American Airlines, all of these alphabet agencies and corporations that were tied into the events of 9/11 were running PTECH software. And then when you look that the head of PTECH is actually on this, you know, America's, you know, terror watch list, or not the watch list, but, you know, is deemed an international terrorist. Are you familiar with the PTECH story?
I've heard it. I think I've read about it. But see, that gets into my overall historic construct. Notice that I'm looking at this not simply from an investigative point of view. I'm really more looking at it from a historical point of view. And historically, we can see what PROMIS represents. It represents, in a sense, a breakthrough in terms of electronic intelligence, in terms of computerized intelligence. The ability with the backdoor installed to access files, to access information from this system on other software systems. So it's part of that historical context of what I call the spy state, what the national security apparatus that has grown up in the United States. And the nature of intelligence in this country. And we bring it down to now, we look at PTECH. And again, we're looking at software. We're looking at the connections, possibly to 9/11. There, it's all part of the grand idea of what I call the spy state. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of electronic intelligence, computerized intelligence, the ability to spy electronically, and at this point, digitally right now. And I think that's the importance of INSLAW. I think that's the importance of this scandal and what has gone on, or the importance of PROMIS and what's gone on with INSLAW and what happened to that company and what has happened to William Hamilton and his wife in regards to INSLAW. I think that's the important part. So I'm looking at it from an historical point of view. It's not a matter for me of just saying, of investigating the death of Danny Kessler, which I'm not doing full time. I'm looking at the INSLAW aspect of it And I'm looking at it from an historical viewpoint, which I think we really need to do. We need to be able to connect all these dots and begin to see what has emerged. And what has emerged, I say, is the spy state.
If I may, and again to reference the book by late Jim Keith and Ken Thomas, The Octopus, there in the new, or the most recent, I suppose, paperback edition, they add in a September 11th epilogue. And if I may just kind of read from this briefly.
Yes, please.
Ever expanding and morphing into new, more sinister applications, the Promise software remains a thing of legend and fact. Legend has it that the Echelon satellite system, which can photograph automobile license plates from outer space, utilizes some mutation of Promise's extrapolation capabilities to fill in the visual contents of those long-distance photos. That's legend. Fact has it that the coming smart card, a credit card-sized surveillance tool that can hold over 5 gigs of info on its holder, has been pioneered in the Hong Kong transit system under the name the Octopus Card. Fact and legend about Promise came together after the world-changing disasters that occurred on 9/11. An Irish nationalist known as MacGuffin gave an unsourced report that Osama bin Laden avoided capture by the U.S. military in the months after 9/11 by using Promise. He asserted that the FBI turncoat Robert Hansen passed the version of Promise used by British and German intelligence onto Russia, where it proceeded to find itself in the hands of the notorious chief Arab terrorist. So that's just the first two paragraphs of this 9/11 epilogue added to the Octopus. And again, spotting the pop culture references, this Irish nationalist known as MacGuffin. Are you familiar with the term MacGuffin?
Yes, it was popularized by Alfred Hitchcock. It's usually the thing or object that a entity or a party in a film wants, right? The MacGuffin is what they're looking for, what they want to get their hands on, what they want to acquire. So it's an interesting little little name, MacGuffin. He's calling himself obvious.
But doesn't he? And I'm actually now typing it up to try and pull it up here. That, and here you go, Wikipedia. MacGuffin is a plot element that catches the viewer's attention or drives the plot of a work of fiction. But didn't Hitchcock go on to say that basically it's... So, well, here we go. 1966 interview with Francois Truffaut and Alfred Hitchcock talking about MacGuffin. It might be a Scottish name taken from a story about two men in a train. One man says, "What's that package up there in the baggage rack?" And the other answers, "Oh, that's a MacGuffin." The first one asks, "What's a MacGuffin?" Well, the other man says, "It's an apparatus for trapping lions in the Scottish Highlands." The first man says, "But there are no lions in the Scottish Highlands." So the other man answers, "Well, then that's no MacGuffin." So you see, a MacGuffin is nothing at all. Is it a red herring plot device?
It's a means to an end, right? Because it's used to drive the plot of a film, right? It can be used to drive the plot. So it's a means to an end, right? So what we have is a guy who calls himself MacGuffin. Obviously, calling himself that because making reference to the Alfred Hitchcock term, popularized by Alfred Hitchcock. But it's also, normally with a MacGuffin, again, it's something that is considered of interest, right? Normally, if you use the term MacGuffin in a film, it's of interest. Could be nothing, but it's still of interest to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I was going to say, as we now start to wrap it up, I'm not sure that that the listeners or myself can add on any more information. But again, I will do my best in the show notes for this episode to add in a lot of these links and give you a lot of the Keystone, Rosetta Stone articles and also the current affair and some of the media reports as well.
Right.
How best, Albert, do you want to wrap this up?
Well, I will say that, as I mentioned before, I mentioned about the spy state. So I'm looking at this in a historical context. I should note, on a very sobering term, that this is a subject that has resulted, obviously, in the deaths of not just Danny Casolaro, but Anson Ng, supposedly, in regards to the octopus. Anson Ng, who was a stringer for Financial News, died in Guatemala. There have been deaths associated with the octopus, with its law, with the whole promise scandal, in one form or another. So this isn't a joke. That's what I want to emphasize. It's not a joke. And I do want to emphasize that I just find this very important. And it isn't just some, it isn't something that could be the plot of a movie. It's something that's very real. And, if we had people in obviously this guy Nathan, this reporter Nathan Baca did a fine job investigating, that element in Indio, California with the deaths of the vice chair of the Cabezon Indian Reservation and his friend and the friend's girlfriend. I thought that was a very good investigation. People should look it up if they can. The station KESQ, the reporter's name is Nathan Baca. I believe he won an Emmy Award for that. But what's important to note about this is, as I mentioned before, the whole idea of the spy state, you have to look at this from a historical point of view. You have to connect the dots. This isn't just the death of a reporter, Danny Casolaro. It isn't just a software company that's in a dispute, as the Justice Department would say, the contract dispute. This isn't a software company that's in a contract dispute with justice. It's more than that. It's more than We're talking about software that's being used for intelligence purposes, that's using for spy purposes, that's being has been modified, that has been used for, I would argue, nefarious purposes.
Absolutely.
And a violation of the law, as Basin brought out, and the bankruptcy court judge brought out. We're talking about, and he put it plainly, he stated that it was trickery, fraud, and deceit on the part of the Department of Justice. My belief is this. The Department of Justice knew what they were doing. They set the Hamiltons up. Think about this. The Promise software was developed under monies provided by the federal government through the LEAA, which is the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which meant that the federal government owned the original Promise, or Promise 1.0, as I like to call it. Now, with this enhanced Promise, the rights generally would go to the InSlaw Inc. Inslaw Corporation, because this was proprietary software. Even though it's a modified version of the original, it still technically belongs to InSlaw. Now, a judge later ruled that, the government has owns all the versions of Promise. They owned it all the time, and they could do what they want with it. I beg to differ. I don't believe the government did. I believe the government believes they did. And this is part of the reason they were fueled, basically, their efforts to destroy InSlaw Inc. This is why they did it. They were setting the Hamiltons up. They felt they were going to be able to win this because they owned the original Promise. So they thought, we're not going to have a big problem getting the software. And they also, I believe, had a backup plan. I think that's why they copied it. That's why they pirated the software. They were, the Hamiltons fought back. They took, they took them to bankruptcy court. They took them to, district court. Or they went to district court. They went to Supreme Court. They fought back. Justice Department didn't like that. So at some point, they had to be able to get that software by hook or by crook. You gotta keep in mind that this was installed in at least 20 offices, I think at the time, during the contract initially. And it was installed in more and more U.S. attorneys' offices, which the Hamiltons didn't agree to. They didn't agree to to have this installed in more offices than per the contract. The Justice Department knew what they were doing. They're not innocent. They're not lambs. They knew fully the consequences of what they were doing, and they didn't care because they thought they could get away with it. And some may argue that they have. You know, there was a report by, Nicholas Bua, who was a retired judge, that absolved the Justice Department. This was in 93 or 94. It absolved the Justice Department. And you look at the AGs like Janet Reno and the AG under the Bush administration. They basically wrote that, oh, the Justice Department didn't have a problem. You know, it wasn't their fault. They didn't owe any Hamilton to any money. It wasn't their responsibility. So this has been whitewashed by the Justice Department. And this is what we have to keep in mind. My belief is they knew what they were doing. The Justice Department knew what they were doing. And they set them up. It is all the earmark for that, as far as I'm concerned. As for Danny Castellaro and his death, I don't believe this. And I don't think I want to go any further into that.
Well, and I hear the sirens in the background there.
Yeah. Hopefully not for me. it's ironic that if you hear sirens just when I start talking about Danny Castellaro again, but.
And again, this is serious, you know, and we do it, you know, in a somewhat conversational way, and we may crack jokes here and there, but this is deathly serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is. And that's why I don't want to go further into the whole death of Danny Castellaro, frankly.
But I think we're going to provide the path, I think, for folks to go investigate this for themselves.
I think Danny Castellaro and his family deserve better. I see no indications that I just don't think that he committed suicide. I just can't buy that. Could he have done it? Yes. Do I believe he did it? No.
Nope.
I think any sane, rational person looking at these details has to conclude that this was a murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, my friend, Albert Lanier. I thank you for joining MediaMonarchy.com again and going over again the tentacles of this octopus.
I do want to add one more thing.
Please.
If anyone does have any details about Inslaw, Promise, and some of the aspects of the software, the derivatives therein, even PTET perhaps, if it's relating to or Echelon, if it relates to that, if they have any detail, they know anything, if they have any interesting, real aspects to this aspect, to this case regarding Inslaw and Promise, they can contact me on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, and I'm on MySpace, and they can send me an email at ajlanier01@msn.com.
And I'll include that again in the show notes.
Great.
All right. Albert, thanks so much for joining us again, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on Media Market.
Housekeeping!
On what seemed like an ordinary Saturday afternoon in the summer of 1991, a housekeeper at the Sheraton Hotel opened room 517 for routine cleaning. Nothing could prepare her for what she found inside.
Oh, God.
Lying in a tub of bloody water was a guest registered to the room. Clearly, the man was dead. The housekeeper discovered the body of Danny Castellaro, a 44-year-old investigative journalist from Fairfax, Virginia. Within minutes, Martinsburg police were called to investigate. In the room, they found a brief suicide note which read, "To my loved ones, please forgive me, most especially my son, and be understanding. God will let me in."
Hi, Tom.
Lieutenant.
What do you got here?
Seems pretty clear it's a suicide. We got a note here. Got about a dozen slash marks on the wrist.
In the bathtub, police recovered a single razor blade.
Didn't hear anything.
Incredibly, Castellaro's wrist was slashed 12 times, with 8 cuts on his left wrist and 4 on his right. One cut was deep enough to sever a tendon. The reporter's wallet was found in his room with cash and credit cards intact. There appeared to be no evidence of a struggle.
Why don't you wrap it up here as quickly as you can and we'll get out of here. Good job.
You got it.
Castellera's body was delivered to a Martinsburg funeral home later Saturday afternoon. However, 2 days passed before Castellera's family was notified of his death.
My mother called me and, you know, she said, Danny's dead, they've killed him. And I called the police at that point. She didn't really know any details and spoke with the sergeant doing the investigation.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Castellero. I'm calling about Danny Castellero.
Yes, I just spoke with the mother. How can I help you?
Yes. What happened?
And he said, we found your brother and he committed suicide.
Suicide. The hotel maid found his body when she went in to clean his room on Saturday around 1 o'clock.
Saturday? This is Monday.
I asked them why it had taken them 2 days to notify us, and he at the moment didn't know. He just said he thought we had already been notified.
Sir, no. Look, what do you know about my brother?
I started asking questions. What about all the papers he had with him, the investigation he was doing, and the sergeant was clearly really didn't have any idea about this. And at that point told me they found no papers in his room.
The papers Castellero had with him in Martinsburg included hundreds of notes and documents for more than a year of investigation. Not one has ever been found.
From the moment we heard about his reported suicide, we doubted it, questioned it, wondered about it. It was not his nature to kill himself. So we were suspicious from the first. And then the deeper we dug into it, the more suspicious we became. Suspicious circumstances surrounding the investigation of his alleged suicide.
Danny Castellero's fear of blood tests and other minor medical procedures was well known to his family. They found it incomprehensible that he committed suicide by slashing his wrists a dozen times. Just days before his death, Danny Castellero enthusiastically told friends he was close to breaking the story that had consumed him the past year. It had started as an inquiry into computer software theft, but soon mushroomed into a broad investigation of government corruption that Castellero believed implicated U.S. Justice Department officials. Many suspect that Castellero was silenced because he had found out too much. Danny Castellero's strange odyssey began when he interviewed Bill and Nancy Hamilton, the owners of a computer software company called Inslaw.
First of all, when was the promise software developed and what was it for?
Well, there's a big need for this kind of software.
The Hamiltons had developed a powerful program called Promise that they claimed revolutionized information management by law enforcement agencies. In 1980, the U.S. Justice Department purchased the Inslaw software to handle their millions of case files. Initially, the program earned high praise and handsome returns for Inslaw. Then the climate of justice suddenly changed.
What we'll do first is bring up a menu.
At the beginning of the second year of the three-year contract, the Justice Department began to withhold payments from Inslaw. And they withheld $2 million from Inslaw. Drove Inslaw into Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
The Hamiltons then discovered that the Canadian government had acquired their software, despite the fact that Inslaw had never sold the program to Canada.
What sort of funny things started happening?
The Hamiltons told Castellero that they were mystified by illegal sales of their software until they spoke to a man named Michael Riconosciuto. He claimed to have worked for the CIA on numerous top-secret projects. Riconosciuto agreed to talk to Unsolved Mysteries about the unauthorized use of Inslaw software by clandestine agencies.
Well, the parties that were involved in the distribution of this software were involved in covert operations, and they were involved in Nicaragua and Central America, and they were involved in operations in the Middle East. And yes, I have direct knowledge of funds from the sale of this product being used to finance those operations.
As early as August of 1989, the brewing Inslaw scandal had drawn the attention of Congress, and the House Judiciary Committee opened a formal inquest.
The report describes the committee's investigation
into serious allegations that high-level Department of Justice officials were involved in a criminal conspiracy to force Inslaw, a small computer company, out of business, steal its...
Michael Rick Onosciuto began telling his story to committee investigators. Within a week of submitting his sworn affidavit to the committee, Rick Onosciuto was arrested on drug charges by agents of the Justice Department. He is currently being held in federal custody in Chicago, Illinois. While the drug conviction taints Reconosciuto's credibility, the committee also heard from a witness with impeccable credentials, Elliot Richardson. Now legal counsel for the Hamiltons, Richardson was attorney general under Richard Nixon. In 1973, Richardson had resigned rather than participate in the Watergate cover-up.
There is simply too much to be ignored. In the case of Inslaw, there's a spreading radius of circumstantial evidence which, at its outer reaches, entails a far more sinister kind of conspiracy than anything revealed in Watergate.
Do you have any information as to whether or not they acquired the promised software?
After months of investigation, Castellaro believed he had uncovered an unsavory network of U.S. officials, organized crime members, and intelligence agents. He called it the Octopus.
Is that being used by their intelligence operations?
Castellaro claimed the Octopus was at the root of not only the Inslaw affair, but the Iran-Contra scandal, BCCI, BNL, and even the now largely discredited October Surprise. In short, just about every major scandal of the 1980s.
Effort direct connections with some of the underworld crime figures.
The deeper Castellaro went in search of the Octopus, the more he found himself on intimate terms with shadowy characters.
Danny Castellaro stepped into a world that he didn't belong in. The type of people that he became involved with lie just as a matter of course. I think after a while, some of them don't even know what the real truth is. They lie, they cheat. There are people involved in numerous murders, dealing drugs, dealing arms. And Danny Castellaro thought he could find his way through this labyrinth by himself. And that was a mistake.
Are you serious? I don't know. I don't think so.
A week before he died, Castellaro told his brother he had been receiving frequent death threats.
What are these guys? Well, I don't know. I mean, I know a couple of them. They're the guys that I've been working with, my contacts. And they're calling me and saying, look, Danny, you're getting too close. You're going to get hurt. Back off. And I'm getting calls in the middle of the night from guys I've never heard of. I don't recognize their voices. I don't know where they're coming from. They're just saying, you are going to die. I'll tell you this, though. When I go to Martinsburg, if something happens to me or if I should get hurt... don't believe it's an accident.
With briefcases full of notes and documents, Castellaro arrived in Martinsburg to meet with several informants and conclude his investigation. He had been tracking the finances of the Octopus and believed one of his new contacts would deliver key evidence. He had been tracking the finances of the Octopus and believed one of his new contacts would deliver key evidence.
Danny had a source there inside the IRS's computer data center that was giving him hard copy printouts of IRS information on certain specific targets that Danny was after.
William Turner?
And you are?
Danny Castellaro?
Get in.
The day before he died, Castellaro met with another source, William Turner, a former employee of a major defense contractor.
You have some documentation?
You have some for me?
Driver's license.
According to Turner, he handed over paperwork documenting corruption that Castellaro believed was tied to the Octopus.
Housekeeping.
Within 24 hours, Castellaro would be found dead, and Turner's documents would disappear along with the rest of Castellaro's papers. In response to the controversy surrounding Castellaro's death, authorities in West Virginia convened a formal inquest, including a complete autopsy.
Assistant medical examiner for the state of West Virginia. He said, well, you know, he's already been embalmed, and that's going to make it a little difficult. And I said, well, what are you talking about? He's already been embalmed. And he said, well, he was embalmed apparently already. He said, you didn't know that? I said, absolutely not. I said, we didn't give any permission. I said, is that how what's supposed to happen? He said, no, that's not. He said, but we'll just have to look into that.
I'm now going to cut the sutures to examine the wounds.
The autopsy confirmed the bleeding from the 12 razor cuts that resulted in Danny Casalero's death. More importantly, the autopsy disclosed evidence suggesting Casalero may not have been alone in the hotel room during the final moments of his life.
6 cuts from the flexor surface of the left wrist.
I was told there were no signs of any struggle. There was, on the actual autopsy report, described a bruise on the arm and a bruise on the head, which were never accounted for. Additionally, the tips of 3 fingernails were missing from one hand.
You know, the other things, the embalming, whatever, you think, well, you know, things can happen and just accept things. But this, they did not tell us the truth. He had bruises on him.
Casalero's hotel room had been cleaned the day after his death by a professional cleaning crew, and the workers inadvertently discarded important evidence. The previous day, minutes after Casalero's body had been found, one of the Sheraton housekeepers noticed 2 bloody towels in the bathroom. They appeared to have been used to wipe blood off the bathroom floor. The question of who tried to clean up the floor with the towels has never been addressed by West Virginia authorities.
The police reports of the investigation, certainly not professional. Fingerprints get lost, messed up. They drain the tub without a string. Sloppy work. What were the towels doing underneath the sink? The police did not check them. Police have a rule in this country, and government people have a rule. When they screw up, they cover up. Sad but true. Do I think they covered up here? Yes, I do.
There is enough evidence that he was murdered so that there should have been a much more intensive investigation than there has been. I don't know enough to know for sure, but all that I do know makes me believe that it was more likely that he was murdered than that he committed suicide.
Our brother Danny Casalero has gone to his rest in the peace of Christ, with faith and hope in eternal life.
Even Casalero's funeral was clouded by mystery.
And assist him with our...
As the ceremony was drawing to a close, a highly decorated military officer arrived in a limousine.
It was really unusual because I noticed this tall, stoic-looking black man in full military dress standing there with this, like, plainclothes type of guy.
Just before the casket was lowered into the ground, the military man carefully placed the medal on the casket lid.
And we went back to Francis's house, Danny's mother's house, and I said, Francis, who was the military man? And she said, I thought you'd know. Don't you know that guy? And I said, no. And we asked everyone there. There had to be 50 people at Francis's house. No one knew who they were. No one.
West Virginia authorities and Department of Justice representatives declined to participate in this broadcast. Casalero's family and friends are convinced he did not commit suicide. The official inquiry into Casalero's death was concluded more than a year ago. However, Casalero's clothing, wallet, suicide note, and other personal items have been retained with no explanation by the investigators.
CNN has learned that congressional investigators will recommend the appointment of another special prosecutor, this time to investigate the Inslaw case. At issue are allegations that the Reagan administration stole computer software. The case also involves the death of a journalist. CNN's Casey Wyan has that.
1 year ago today, freelance journalist Danny Casalero was found dead in this hotel room in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Local authorities quickly ruled his death a suicide. But Casalero's family and colleagues believe he may have been killed because he was close to uncovering an explosive story involving this Washington, D.C. company. Inslaw designed a computer software program called Promise in the late 1970s, the goal to track cases for the Justice Department. But in the early 80s, Justice and Inslaw fought over payments and ownership of the software. By 1985, Inslaw was bankrupt. 2 years later, bankruptcy judge George Basin ruled the Justice Department stole Inslaw's software by trickery, fraud, and deceit. The ruling was later thrown out on jurisdictional grounds. Inslaw owner Bill Hamilton has battled the Justice Department for 8 years. He claims there's more to the story than theft.
the theft was part of a much larger conspiracy involving the highest levels of the Reagan White House, the Reagan Justice Department, in order to enable political supporters that helped Reagan and Bush win election in 1980, obtain lucrative contracts with the United States government to sell pirated copies of our software.
Sworn but unsubstantiated testimony from this arms dealer and this jailed weapons expert claim Inslaw's software was sold to dozens of intelligence agencies.
The Justice Department refused to comment for this story, but has consistently denied any wrongdoing. Congress has been investigating the Inslaw case for 3 years. Its findings are scheduled to be made public on Tuesday.
Congressional sources say the report is hard-hitting and disturbing. It will detail flaws in the investigation of Casolaro's death. They also say it uncovers evidence of misconduct by high-level Justice Department officials. To determine the degree of that wrongdoing, the report will recommend the appointment of a Watergate-style special prosecutor to investigate the Inslaw case. Casey Wyand, CNN Business News, Washington.
Hello, thanks for joining us. Tonight, the international spy scandal with an Australian connection, and later we'll talk to South Africa's Foreign Minister, Pik Botha, a man on a mission to improve relations between Canberra and Pretoria. It's a spy scandal that's already rocked the White House, an intrigue that could threaten the presidency of George Bush. This story centers on incredible allegations of spying on a scale never before imagined. It involves America's Central Intelligence Agency selling computer programs to foreign nations. These programs allegedly allowed the CIA to spy on the intelligence agencies that bought it. And one of the purchasers was Australia. We've been able to track down two key witnesses to those dealings, witnesses who are now in fear of their lives. Michael Holmes reports.
It may be the most bizarre spy story ever. A story of corruption and betrayal at the highest levels of the American government. A story of hostages used as pawns. Of the CIA spying on its friends. Of murders made to look like suicides.
I think it's about time to get the whole story out.
His name is Ari Ben-Menashe. He's a former Israeli intelligence agent.
Once it's out, there's no reason to hurt me physically anymore.
And today, he is hiding in Australia, in fear, he says, of his life.
So many people in the last 10 years who were working for the various governments on these issues, due to cover-ups, died mysteriously.
He claims the United States tried to spy on ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, by selling it a computer program that contained a hidden keyhole, a lock for which the CIA had a master key. The computer software is called Promise. It's designed to track millions of pieces of information on tens of thousands of people. And it's alleged to have been installed in dozens of government departments and security agencies around the world. It's also alleged that American intelligence made some small modifications to the program, modifications that enabled it to key in a special access code and gain entry to all the information on the computer.
It would be equivalent to going into ASIO or ASIO and reading the handwritten files of all the agents, except the computer has them neatly organized and typed and instantly indexed, so it's much more convenient.
Bill Hamilton owns Inslaw, the company that developed Promise and offered it to the American government.
They would not have bothered to sell it to all these countries without first preparing it in such a way that it would be an easier avenue of penetration into the files of these foreign governments.
The whole story might never have emerged, but for the fact that the American government didn't own Promise. It pirated the software from Bill Hamilton's company.
We were dumbfounded. Couldn't conceive of it.
Hamilton's contract with the U.S. Department of Justice to supply the Promise software was cancelled in 1982 without any real explanation. Only some time later did Hamilton hear that his software was turning up all over the world.
I don't know how much Australia paid. I've been told that Israel paid $5.5 million.
Ari Ben-Menashe confirms that Promise was sold to Israel, but claims the Israelis, unlike the Australians, were in on the secret.
The whole idea was that we would study it, the Americans then would sell it to our neighbors, and then we could, by using telephone lines, get into their our neighbors' computers. But then our American friends just took it a step further. They sold it to their allies as well, including Australia.
The list of countries which allegedly bought the Promise software reads like a who's who of America's friends, as well as its most bitter enemies.
Is spying on your friends considered a fair thing to do in the intelligence world?
Oh, it is. It's always done. Using a Trojan horse to go inside the agency, that gets a little aggressive.
It all sounds a bit too bizarre to be true, but we've now been able to track down a key witness to a prison near Seattle in Washington State.
So you are 100% sure that Promise or a derivative of Promise was bought by Australia to be used in our intelligence and law enforcement agencies?
Absolutely, because I spent several thousand man hours of programming time with a programming team, developing that subset.
This unlikely looking character is a computer genius. His name is Michael Riconosciuto, and he says he was in charge of modifying the Promise program so that it could be accessed by American intelligence.
So whoever was holding that master key could do what?
Basically, break into it and spy.
ASIO says it doesn't have and has never had the Promise software. Of course, it won't go into any detail about what sort of computer programs it does have, which is very handy because, according to Michael Riconosciuto, the Promise software was often altered and given different names before it was sold. Indeed, Riconosciuto claims he specifically modified the program for Australia at the request of ASIO.
I basically had to change the communications protocol, which is how that software package interacts with other software packages already resident in the computer system.
In a federal court hearing, Judge George Basin ruled the Justice Department had used illegal and underhanded methods to bankrupt Bill Hamilton's Inslaw company. He ordered the government to pay Inslaw $8 million.
Yeah.
Trickery, fraud, and deceit. You use those words when describing how the Justice Department stole the software. Do you stand by those words?
Yes. There's no question in my mind about it. The evidence was overwhelming.
So why was the Justice Department so desperate to get the software from Bill Hamilton? To answer that, you have to go back to 1980. Iran had seized American hostages.
All evidence proves that these people are spies.
If President Carter could secure their release, he'd have a big advantage in the upcoming U.S. elections.
My thoughts and my prayers for our hostages in Iran are as though they were my own sons and daughters.
It's now alleged that the Reagan campaign made a deal with the Iranians, a deal to keep the hostages until after the election, thus denying Carter the credit for their freedom. The man alleged to have helped organize this deal is a Reagan political crony called Earl Bryan, and his payoff 3 years later on the Promise software. About an hour and a half outside Washington, D.C., you'll find this place, Earl Bryan's multi-million dollar country estate. If you believe Michael Riconosciuto, it's the house Promise bought. Now, we'd like to bring you Earl Bryan personally denying that claim, but he's not being interviewed by anybody. All we got was this letter from his lawyers threatening action if we so much as associate Earl Bryan's name with this story.
He had the contacts to help make sure that certain elements in Iran would not make a deal with President Carter in 1980 so that President Carter could not recover in the polls and that Reagan would win the election.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear that
just 5 minutes after Ronald Reagan took the oath of office, Iran announced that the hostages would be released.
Some 30 minutes ago, the planes bearing our prisoners left Iranian airspace and are now free.
Okay.
And the story doesn't end there. In a moment, the murders that have been linked to the spy scandal. There are many shady characters in this story, spies, former spies, people with something to hide. But there are players with impeccable credentials too. In part two of this investigation, we meet a man whose background more than qualifies him to know a scandal when he smells one.
What is being said about this conspiracy points to criminal conduct much worse than anything in Watergate.
And Elliot Richardson should know. 17 years ago, he resigned as U.S. Attorney General on a matter of principle after clashing with Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal. Today, Richardson is legal counsel for Inslaw, and once again, he has the White House in his sights.
It might be reluctant to have it emerge that the U.S. government had, through clandestine means, planted software on foreign intelligence agencies so that the U.S. would be better able, as the phrase goes, to read their mail.
The number of murders that have occurred to prevent leaks are incredible. There's nearly 50 murders that can be directly ascribed to this pattern of activity.
The promise affair and the allegation that Ronald Reagan and George Bush made a deal for the hostages to be kept until after the 1980 election were being investigated by journalist and author Danny Casolaro.
He said he had it. He had some already, and he was going to West Virginia to meet the source who had given him that evidence. This source was now, he said, going to supply additional conclusive proof.
But Danny Casolaro never got to reveal either his source or the hard evidence he said was going to break the scandal wide open. On August the 10th, his body was found in this hotel room in West Virginia. His wrists had been slashed an incredible 12 times. Danny Casolaro's body was found naked in a pool of bloody water in the bathtub. All his papers were gone. Within hours, local police had declared the death a suicide.
You have a case of forensic artistry, you know, shall we say, where you have professionally trained people that set up a crime scene, and they make it phenomenally difficult for investigators to backtrack, make a murder look like a suicide.
His body was embalmed by Monday morning by the time we found out. That is against law in West Virginia. His body was embalmed without family consent. That certainly makes an autopsy a little more difficult.
Tony Casolaro says his brother Danny, pictured here at a nephew's birthday, just wasn't the suicidal type.
He was describing for me a few weeks before he died what he was doing and some of the people involved. And he said a lot of accidents had happened to people who were working on the things that he had been working on. He said, you know, if an accident happens to me, don't believe it.
But bad things seem to happen to people who make waves in the Inslaw affair. Earlier this year, Michael Riconosciuto contacted Bill Hamilton and signed a sworn affidavit for Hamilton's lawsuit against the Justice Department. Do you believe Michael Riconosciuto did alter the software as he claimed he did?
Yes, I do.
Almost immediately, Riconosciuto was contacted by a Justice Department official and given a very clear message.
Back off or else.
Less than 2 weeks after that threat, Michael Riconosciuto was arrested on drug charges.
My main concern right now is staying alive and protecting my family.
Right.
And remember Judge Basin, who found in favor of Inslaw against the Justice Department?
Right.
Well, a few months later, Judge Basin's reappointment to the bench, thought to be a formality, was blocked by the Justice Department.
Yeah.
His career has been destroyed. Would you still be a judge if you hadn't handed down the decision you did?
I think I would be. I rendered the, quote, wrong decision in the case of Inslaw versus Department of Justice.
Your replacement in the bankruptcy court was a lawyer who argued for the Justice Department in this case.
Yes.
Does that smell? Is that worthy?
It's certainly an odd coincidence, isn't it?
every time you figuratively pick up a rock, in this case, you find maggots under it.
Michael Holmes reporting on the saga that is now the subject of a U.S. congressional inquiry.
It's a story you will only see on News Channel 3 at 11.
Department of Justice officials were involved in a criminal conspiracy to force Intel, a small computer company, out of business.
A top secret government computer program comes back to haunt the U.S. Tonight, you'll see how that program is now being connected to multiple local murder cases. It's 11 o'clock, time for news.
Now, from the desert's news leader, KESQ News Channel 3 HD at 11.
Hello, I'm Tamara DeMonte.
And I'm John White. There are new developments tonight in a year-long News Channel 3 investigation. The Riverside County Sheriff's Department is looking into possible connections between a triple murder back in 1981 and a murder-suicide in 2005 that claimed six lives.
It's a story you will only see right here on News Channel 3 at 11. The reporter, Nathan Baca.
John, Tamara, we have internal documents from the Cold Case Division of the Riverside County Sheriff's Department showing the depth of the investigation. We will not reveal the investigator's identity at this time, since the documents show their lives may be in danger. Now we are alerting the murders may be a cover-up for one of the federal government's most secret computer programs.
Promise is the name of one of the government's most secret computer database programs. Computer programmer Michael Reconosciuto wrote in this affidavit that major modifications to the program were made here in Indio.
On July 1st, 1981, Fred Alvarez, his girlfriend Patty Castro, and friend Ralph Boger were shot to death here on Bob Hope Drive in Ranch Mirage. There was a house here that has since been bulldozed. Nobody was ever arrested for the shooting.
Family friends say Cabazon Band of Mission Indians Vice Chairman Fred Alvarez was going to blow the whistle on this. Documents from the early 1980s showing a business partnership between defense contractor Wackenhut Services and Cabazon manager John Philip Nichols to form Cabazon Arms. One of their alleged projects was the Promise Computer Program. Database and pattern recognition software was a new source of information and power in the early 1980s. It starts when the program's designers, Inslaw Corporation, accused the U.S. Justice Department of stealing the software for their own foreign policy purposes. This programmer testified he altered the program to create what's called a back door to allow government spying. This happened while working on Cabazon Indian sovereign land.
Well, the parties that were involved in the distribution of this software were involved in covert operations, and they were involved in Nicaragua and Central America, and they were involved in operations in the Middle East.
This U.S. Justice Department memo from 1985 shows the Promise software was being sold to Middle Eastern arms dealers and wanted no paperwork or customs inspections to interfere. Even unsolved mysteries got on the case when the last journalist to investigate this spy scandal was found dead in his hotel room. Danny Casalero's wrists were slashed in 1991. It was ruled a suicide. But his reporter notes disappeared, and the book on the conspiracy he was to title Indio was never finished. Congressional hearings were held in 1992.
Describes the committee's investigation into serious allegations that high-level Department of Justice officials were involved in a criminal conspiracy to force Inslaw, a small computer company, out of business.
The hearings ended inconclusively.
The Promise software was allegedly altered on tribal land in India with a lack of federal oversight. And just like Microsoft Windows, the database program kept up with the times, upgraded several times over the years.
But Promise came back to haunt America in ways never imagined.
A disturbing indication that Robert Hansen, the FBI man accused of spying for the Russians in what officials said at the time of his arrest was a massive security breach, ended up helping Osama bin Laden. As correspondent Carl Cameron reports, Hansen sold the Russians an extremely sensitive piece of U.S. technology, and the indications are that they, in turn, sold it to bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network.
From an office in India to foreign capitals all over the world, several murder investigations are connected to this spy scandal. Whether answers can still be found 27 years later remains in the hands of the sheriff's cold case squad.
The internal documents we've obtained and confidential interviews we've done reveal the Riverside County Sheriff's Cold Case Squad is investigating whether DA investigator David McGowan was on this 27-year-old murder case before his 2005 death. We are still looking into whether they've concluded that angle of their questioning. Now, if you have missed any part of this 31-part exclusive investigation, more than 1 year in the making, log on to our website at KESQ.com. On the right-hand side, click on Special Reports, and then the icon that says Inside the DA's Office and DHS, please. John Tamer. We are looking into more answers, and right now the Cabazon Band of Mission Indians still have not responded to our questions at this point.
Okay, you're part 31 of this investigation. Where is it going next?
Well, the next part we look forward to doing is revealing a little bit more of the confidential information, the internal documents. Very chilling information where a detective is basically saying that they cannot look their wife in the eyes and tell her that they are willing to risk the life of their family by pursuing this case. So they're basically asking to get off the case. A lot more on that coming up very soon.
Why won't the DA's office say whether or not David McGowan was looking into this?
Their official stance is that David McGowan was not looking into this. That is their official stance, according to their spokespeople. But at this point, there have been a lot of questions that have been asked. Friends and partners of David McGowan have been asked questions about what cases he was working on before the 2005 deaths.
Okay. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.